make our strategies around the excuses our customers were giving us after we got a no. When you make your strategies around the things people are actually using to make their decisions, magical things tend to happen. People tend to mix those two words up, right? They think persuasion is the same as coercion, manipulation, intimidation. It shows that we need to differentiate a true gift versus a reward. If there are strings attached, if you do this, then you get this, that's a reward. So in a popular study here in the States with a popular restaurant in Chicago, they had a 30% no-show rates on reservations to this restaurant. Well, they changed that by turning it into a commitment question from please call us if you can't make it to, hey Zach, will you please call us if you can't make your reservation? Just that one simple act of commitment question dropped no-show rates from 30% to 10.
Why do I trust the 4.3 review more than the 5 review?
Lead early on in the conversation with the weakness in your case first, and studies show that's a credibility shortcut. That builds trust faster with that person in that moment than anything else possible.
Dr. Chris Phelps, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jack. Thanks for having me.
It's amazing to have you. I've been really, really looking forward to this one. I'm going to hit you with a big open question, Chris. Who are you? What problem do you solve?
Wow, great question. So I am the U.S. CEO of the Cialdini Institute, named after and founded by proclaimed and world-renowned behavioral psychologist, Dr. Robert Cialdini. Wrote a book, Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion, written over 40 years ago, yet not only still present today, more relevant than it's ever been in what his research found. So what problem do we solve is this, right? I find oftentimes we tend to make strategies around, and from the business standpoint, sales, marketing, whatever, we make our strategies around the excuses our customers were giving us after we got a no to our request, buy this product, move this direction, et cetera. What we do at the Cialdini Institute is actually teach, educate, consult on what people are actually using to make the majority of their decisions. Why do they really say no to you? And what factors are they using that tend to lead to a yes? Because when you make your strategies around the things people are actually using to make their decisions, magical things tend to happen.
That's a beautiful answer, Chris. I want to use today as a real masterclass. So for anybody listening that's maybe read the book or they've listened to it on Audible, I want this to be a real in-depth, something that they can take away, and we'll probably go through all the steps. But before we dive in your words, what's the difference between influence and manipulation?
Ooh, great question. And I get that one asked a lot. In fact, oftentimes people tend to mix those two words up, right? They think persuasion is the same as coercion, manipulation, intimidation, forcing people to do stuff, you know, putting a gun to their head, or sometimes just telling people to do stuff. We call that hierarchical authority. So somebody in charge of you, a boss, a police officer, what have you, somebody telling you to do stuff, right? When in fact, the only thing that really unites them is persuasion, coercion, manipulation, intimidation. They're all under the same category. Right? They're all under the heading of influence. Okay. But if you think about it, under this main category of influence, they're all subcategories. So we've got actually a spectrum, if you will, two different sides. On one end of the spectrum is persuasion. On the very far opposite end of that spectrum is coercion, intimidation, manipulation. Some other things in the middle, money, right? Incentives, bonuses. Okay. Well, yeah, you put some money in front of somebody, it might influence them to take an action. Okay, so what separates these guys if they're on opposite ends of the spectrum? Well, with intimidation, coercion, manipulation, telling people to do stuff, picture putting a gun to somebody's head, they don't feel like they have a viable choice. Not really. Okay, I mean, I guess they kind of do. It's do it or die. But in their world, they don't really feel like it's a viable choice. And in essence, they don't really feel like they're in control. Okay, that's really what it's about. Choice and no control in this scenario. Versus persuasion, the opposite end of the spectrum, is completely about giving them choices. They're totally in control. Nobody's forcing them to do anything. And they have a choice. So they're in control and they have a choice. So persuasion by definition is you as a recipient receive a message. You hear it, you see it, you read it in some format. And something about that message changes your perspective about that thing. It changes your mindset and your thinking about that thing. And that's why you choose to change your behavior. Nobody told you to do it. Nobody forced you to do it. You chose it every step of the way. So persuasion is all about choice and you're in control. Manipulation, force, intimidation, telling people to do stuff. You don't feel like you're in control and don't have a choice.
What a great answer. I'm excited already for this one. Let's get into it then. So let's start off with reciprocity. So the idea of giving first to get later, hopefully, where do you see people using this the best?
Well, you know, truthfully, let's think about why do we do that, right? By definition. So when you give someone a gift of significance and value, an obligation is created inside of you where you feel like you have to give back in kind, right? So where does this obligation come from? It's actually this social external influence on us, right? So think of it this way. What do we call people as a society who don't routinely give back when given to? What do we call those that just take, 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 right? There's no positive word in the English language to describe those people. Moochers, ingrates, parasites, teenagers. Okay. So we don't want others to perceive us in that light, right? As being one of those kind of people. So that's where the obligation comes from. So if given to, we feel the need to give back in that obligation. So where I find some of the most powerful gifts you can give people, on the surface, you think of a gift as a physical, tangible thing you can hand to somebody. Here's a present, here's a gift card, whatever. Actually, some of the more powerful gifts you can give people are those intangible gifts, things you can't quite put your hands on and your fingers on, like doing someone a favor. Somebody does you a favor. Hey, mate, will you help me move this weekend? Yeah, well, guess what? When it's time for them to move, who are they going to call? You, right? So favors are big time intangible gifts we give someone. You'd be shocked to know that sometimes a praise and compliment from someone is perceived as a gift by them, right? Spending your time, active listening. There's a million and one different intangible gifts we can give folks. How do you know that you've given someone a gift of value? Even if it may have not meant anything to you, let's say it's a customer, you were just doing your job, even if they just paid you for it, right? But yet there's still something there, that obligation's still there. Well, when that person says two magic words, you know you've got it. You're in that situation. And the two words are when they genuinely say, thank you. Thank you for whatever, for doing that for me, for taking that off my plate for this thing. So if they're going out of their way to genuinely thank you or praise you for some action or effort you've done, you've already given the gift. And they're still bringing it up because they want to scratch this obligation off their to-do list. We don't like to-do lists. We got enough on them already. So when these things come on our list, we want to get them off our plate as fast as possible. So if in those situations you find yourself in a moment and you've already given a gift, because we give away more of these than we realize each day, see it for what it is. They want to do something to give back in kind. So if you generally had something to ask that person, a request, whatever, now's the time to do it. And you're now more likely than ever to get a yes.
May I, just to make the podcast interesting, may I give a devil's advocate and see what the rebuttal is?
Yeah, sure.
So me and Jack run a business, and as business owners, we accept that we will be sold to, and I quite like the different creative messages that we get. The ones that have a gift card type thing attached to them, like if you sit this meeting with us, you'll get this thing in return, no obligation, I'll give you this, are typically the ones where my guard goes up a little bit and I think, ah, there's going to be like a big ask coming from this one. Am I a skeptical person, or is that a universal experience, do you think, that when you see that, the guard goes up a little bit?
No, it's a big time guard goes up. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because it helps us. It shows that we need to differentiate a true gift versus a reward. Okay. A reward and incentive is exactly what you're describing. Now, they may call it a gift, but it's not a gift by definition. If there are strings attached, if you do this, then you get this, that's a reward. Again, it's a spectrum. That is completely different and opposite of true reciprocity. So gifts are given on the front end first with no expectation of a return. Okay. Rewards always have an expectation of a return. So think of it this way, you know, while gifts are unconditional, Rewards are very conditional. If you do this, then you get this. Rewards tend to end relationships. Well, I did what you said and I got what you said, so I'm done. Satisfied. Contract satisfied. Whereas gifts, true gifts, tend to open relationships instead. So while some people, it's a misnomer, they call it a gift. If there's strings attached, it's a reward. And most studies show that when compared to gifts, most gifts, if it's a true gift, have twice as much influence power to getting people to say yes than a reward. In fact, one big study we cite, a $5 gift card had twice as much influence to get people to say yes versus getting a $50 reward or incentive if they did the thing. So small gifts have a lot more influence than even large rewards.
I love it. Commitment and consistency, Chris, where are businesses going wrong with this?
Yes, great question. This was actually one of the root causes behind the majority of problems in my early businesses, right? The principle of consistency simply states that if people make a commitment, they tend to follow through and do with the commitment that they set, right? So if you get a commitment, they do what they say. Well, I realized, well, why aren't my customers coming back and saying yes for our services? Why my team? Why do I have to keep micromanaging them? Why do I have to keep telling them to do stuff and do their job, right? Why, when the cat's away, the mice will play versus why don't they just do their job, right? My associate doctors, why am I paying for them to go get education, that those docs that work for me, and then why are they not coming back and using the education with their patients, right, so to speak? So all of these kind of issues and fires going on in my businesses, and I couldn't figure out the root cause until I heard Cialdini talk about consistency. And that's really it. So if you get a commitment, they do. If they're not doing, what was I missing? I wasn't getting a commitment out of anyone to do anything. So I realized I had to go back and take a hard look and say, all right, I got to figure out what kind of commitments do I need to get out of people to change their behavior, right? And so I did. And so the type of commitments, you know, we need to get out of people, right, early on in our situation with them is, number one is you got to get an active commitment, okay? Active commitment, one example of that is just simply telling folks that you're going to do something. That's an active commitment. So in a popular study here in the States with a popular restaurant in Chicago, they had a 30% no-show rates on reservations to this restaurant. So it was very popular, had a great authority, won a lot of awards, and they still had a hard time getting people to show up for these reservations for dinner. Well, they would normally make a reservation and end the call with a statement. Hey, please call us if you can't make your appointment. Okay, great. Right? Statements. Well, they changed that by adding, by turning it into a commitment question. From please call us if you can't make it to, hey, Zach, will you please call us if you can't make your reservation? And they waited for them to say, yeah, of course I will. Okay, great. We look forward to seeing you on this night and this time. Just that one simple act of commitment question dropped no-show rates from 30% to 10. Okay. So the idea is if you leave it up here, you're not really committed to it. So you got to tell people you're going to do these things or get them to tell you they're going to do these things to get an active commitment. We got to get public commitments out of people, right? The more people that know you said you were going to do something, the more influence there is on you to do it. Okay. That's that social pressure again. And last but not least, we got to give people voluntary commitments. If you just give them one option, you're basically backing them into a corner. You're telling them, do this, versus simply backing that up and presenting it as a choice. Hey, this or that, which would you prefer? Automatically, you're creating more of a voluntary commitment there. They have a choice now. They don't feel like they're being told and backed into a corner anymore. And every time you present things to this or that scenario, they're making more and more of a commitment to that thing and to do it. So the key with consistency is about understanding that, number one, you need to get better commitments out of people and what type of commitments you need to get, voluntary, public, and active.
Nice, really nice. And then my head was going, so I don't know if this is wrong, but my head when I was reading this and thinking about it today, I was thinking when it comes to like commitments, I would think of a marketing agency that would say, we're going to charge you £10,000 for an SEO audit. And then from there, that's a mini commitment. And also moving forward, we're going to charge you £50,000 a month. Does that fall into that category, or is that something completely different?
Well, if you as the customer of that sign an agreement and it spells out what they're going to do for you, then you as the customer have just made a commitment to not only paying them, but to getting those services. They have made a commitment to provide those services now for that price. So, yeah, in that case, if the person has either verbally agreed to it, oh, yeah, yes, I'll move forward with this, or signed a contract, those are both commitments.
Nice. Let's talk about social proof. So the idea that we follow what we're seeing other people do, we're following the crowd. So there's an interesting piece here that I'd love to get your opinion on. We're obviously tribal beings, so we like to see what the rest of the tribe is doing. But something unique seems to happen in Amazon culture. Why do I trust the 4.3 review more than the 5 review?
Yeah, very interesting. Because I think part of it is this. Most of the time when these principles are present, they kind of trigger us at a subconscious level, right? Rational thought doesn't really come into play. We've learned, because we're so distracted by all the things going on in our world, what's on our phone, social media, everything on our to-do list, we don't have time to make a rational decision about everything. It takes too much mental energy and effort. So when these principles are present, we've learned to lean on them to trigger us to respond. For instance, if you're walking up to a cafe for the first time, right, this morning, and 50 people run out of that place screaming in terror in the other direction, the social proof of that is going to kick in without much thought, right? Are you going to run into the cafe to see what they're running from? No, you're going to turn tail and run with them. And then when you finally get someplace kind of safe, you're going to go, all right, what do we got? What are we running from? Okay. That's the pull of social proof. Okay. So in that case, normally we would be triggered by evidence that others have said something positive about this. In this kind of scenario, sometimes things do break through the surface and get to the rational level of thinking. And our rational level of thinking is this: what are the odds of any business you've ever been into that 100% of the people said perfect reviews? Is there even such a thing? So automatically, we don't believe in perfection. There's no such thing. So if somebody presents it as perfection, automatically that's going to jump right to our experience, right to the rational thought, and say, I don't know, something's not right with that. But this one that's not perfect, it's still the majority. Okay, I'll trust that more.
That's interesting that that's a dialogue that's happening at an almost unconscious level. Interesting. Okay. What do you think is a good example for listeners of maybe a brand that you think of straight away when you think of that's a brand that really demonstrates social proof that other people follow just because they're used by the majority?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, like, history wise, you guys have heard of Amazon, right? Okay. You know, Amazon didn't start their company by selling stuff. Amazon built their business off social proof. Okay. It was one of the first places you could go to. It was a review site. Okay. That's what it was. Okay. It was the first place you could go to that if I want to buy a vacuum cleaner and I wasn't unsure about which one to buy, I could go to Amazon and see, well, geez, 5,000 people said something positive about this vacuum. No one said anything positive about that one. I don't know anything about vacuums, but which one am I more likely to buy now? Right. And so they leverage that power of basically reviewing and letting the community define their opinions about these things, putting that social proof information out there. And it was so popular, it got so many eyeballs. Then, of course, Amazon got smart and decided, well, you know what? Instead of just reviewing this stuff, why don't we sell it? So, and they continue to leverage that today. Right. I see all kinds of companies leveraging social proof in appropriate ways. You know, if I'm going to order an Uber or a Lyft, okay, and I look at my app, you know, there's some inherent uncertainty about using those kind of things. Look, I'm going to get into a random stranger's car. What verification has anybody done to this person to let me know that I'm going to be safe and make it to my destination, right? I remember the first time I put my mom into an Uber. You know, she's retired, she's older, and she wouldn't, in her generation, you didn't get in strangers' cars, right? And next thing I know, she's driving away and looking at me at the back seat like I'm never going to see her again, like that kind of look, like she thinks that's it. She's just going to disappear. So they understood that there's this uncertainty that's holding back their business. So what do you see now? You see driver review ratings. This driver has, you know, same thing, 4.9 out of 5 stars. They actually have over successfully 3,000 successful trips. Okay, so if they've driven with 3,000 people and they've all said something positive overall, all right, maybe I'll be safe taking this Uber or Lyft, right? So I thought that was a powerful way that they've leveraged social proof information to not only get people to use their service, but to get them to use it more often than they would otherwise, because it totally reduced their uncertainty, which is what social proof does.
Beautiful. And then I always think, for the next one, the analogy I think of is if you went up to somebody in a bar, Chris, and started talking at them, and then at the end of it, you just say, I'm a great listener, they're probably going to look at you baffled. So when I think about like authority and trusting the expert, when we're sat on sales calls, I want to be the expert. I want to be the trusted advisor in the room. But I can't tell them that I'm an expert, because they'd look at me and go, you're not an expert, you're a schmuck. Who are you? So I guess how do you build that authority, and how do you maybe do that in a short amount of time?
Yeah, great question. I mean, the authority principle by definition is that you really want to let other people, other items, other things present you as an authority versus you telling people you're the authority, as you said, right? So one simple way, if you're going to be in a group of people, is ideally somebody should introduce you and endorse you to that group, right? At a minimum, introduce you. Just the simple act of an introduction, most studies show that after being introduced, those people now will now take your advice more to heart, right? So you'll get more compliance, you'll be seen more as an expert, just from a simple introduction. Why? Because who normally do we introduce? Important people, successful people. So if you're being introduced to me, you must be smart, you must be important and successful. Adding that endorsement just amplifies the effect to another level. Okay, so have somebody else introduce you and your credentials. If you don't have anybody else directly to do that, then send them that information. Let's say it's a prospect or a potential customer you're going to meet with. Send them your information and all what we call your authority triggers, right? Your credentials, your experience, your rewards, whatever you want to brag about yourself. Send that to them in written form before you get there. That item can present you as an expert. Yeah, it's you wrote it. But it's not you telling them directly. It's this piece of paper now presenting you as the expert. So try to get some kind of introduction with them. So authority is about letting other people, other items, other things present you as the expert. So in essence, you got to show them some expertise. You have to have evidence and get that evidence in front of them without you doing it directly. The other half of the authority principle is really about trust. Okay, we need trustworthy experts to tell us what we should do. That's who we look to for real advice. Okay. You could be an expert about this topic all day long, but if I don't trust you, I'm not going to say yes to you. So what can you do to build trust? And Dr. Cialdini's talked about this in numerous podcasts, but a trust shortcut that's available is if you really had, let's say you're going to present them something, you're going to try to do a sales presentation or whatever. If there really is a negative or a weakness in your case, okay, an elephant in the room, like something you normally might not want to talk about, don't hide it. Start with it. Lead early on in the conversation with the weakness in your case first, and studies show that's a credibility shortcut. That builds trust faster with that person in that moment than anything else possible. And now, if you've been presented as an expert, you've shown that you're an expert they can trust. Why? Because you're being transparent. I'm not trying to hide the negative or the elephant in the room. I'm starting with it. Here's the good and the bad. Okay. Now you got somebody you can trust. Now you got a chance.
And have you, obviously, you're a genius when it comes to these principles. Have you found that in the modern world that we're living in, obviously, in the last 20 years, we've got the internet and everybody's trying to present themselves as an expert or a trusted advisor. Have you seen any examples of people using these principles in the modern world to a higher level?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of people that have leveraged these things in at a high level in degree. And there's also a lot of people, like for the authority principle, that are just barely scratching the surface, right? We have a lot of false authorities out there. You know, one of the things about the authority principle is just simply when we have nothing else to judge a person by, this is one of the first principles we tend to use. Is this person smart? Are they successful? Is it somebody I should be listening to? Right. And so we look for these little cues and trappings of authority that make us think that they might be. And for most people, I hate to say in the consumers out there, because we're so busy and distracted, that's enough. They never look deeper. That's why I say we want credible experts, like people with real expertise and trust, not just someone who looks like they're an expert. Or, you know, I know in my field in dentistry, we have a ton of these dental Facebook groups that have popped up. So communities of dentists all flocking together, talking to each other, whatnot. And what I found is interesting is that the person, the dentist who started that group, Facebook group, through no other effort or energy than the fact that they just started the group to get people talking, they're perceived by others in that community as the expert and are giving actual advice to people in that community when they themselves have never actually done that thing before or have any real true expertise in the matter. You see what I mean? So we got to be careful. The key with the authority is to ask more questions. Go past that surface and say, wait, does this person I'm listening to, I'm following, let's go deeper, right? Do they really have expertise or experience in some way, shape, or form about the subject matter they're talking about? And from what I can tell and the research, is this somebody I can trust, right? So go a little deeper and find a true authority to follow.
Beautiful. So the next one we come to is people buy from people they like. And I feel like there is room to explore in this one and probably all sorts of conclusions, right and wrong, people come to. So I suppose nice and broad, if you could set the stage for what this actually means to kick us off, how would you define it?
Yeah, the liking principle is just simply that. We like to do business with people we like. But if I had to put it simply, two ways. We like to do business with those who are like us, who have commonalities, similarities. At the same time, we like to do business with those who like us and tell us or show us that they like us. Okay. So we'll start there. We love praise and flattery. We love people who compliment us, right? Who show us that they like us. So if somebody's going out of their way to show me they like me, I'm probably going to reciprocate and now like them as a result. Okay. Similarity. This is a big reason why I'm a Rick Astley fan. Okay. So, you know, I followed Rick. I've got all of his albums. I know he's based in the UK. And I thought all this time I loved his music. But when I was in high school in Greensboro, North Carolina, these three girls came up to me and asked me for my autograph. And I was like, I'm sorry, who do you think I am? And they're like, oh, that's not him. He's not British. And I was like, whoa, wait, what? Now I'm really interested. And they said, well, we thought you were Rick Astley. And I was like, why? They go, because you look just like him and he's in concert in town this weekend. We thought you were him. I was like, huh. Well, at the time, I didn't know who Rick Astley was, a high school kid. So, you know, I get in my car and I go to our shopping mall and I go to this crazy thing called a record store. Some of you may remember. And I pull out Rick's album and I see his face on the cover. And if I showed you a picture of me at that time, yeah, I saw the connection. I was like, wow, I kind of do look like this guy. But what did I do? Did I put it back and walk away or did I buy it? I bought it and then I listened to it and I liked it. And I've been a fan of his and followed his career ever since. But the roots of that were because somebody thought we had a connection, similarity. And then I researched it and discovered we had a connection. We had even a mild similarity. So don't underestimate the power of finding something in common, some kind of connection to this person. Ideally, before you get down to talking about the business at hand, right? That's really how this principle works. Remember, it's not about getting people to like you. It's about showing them that you like them first. If you're the first to show them that you like them by telling them you like them, finding this connection and bringing it to the surface, that's, again, showing them that you like them, that you're taking this effort. They're often going to reciprocate and like you back. And if they like you, they're now more likely to do business with you.
Nice. Something about we're never going to give you up. There's a pun in here somewhere. We'll find it. I'm never going to give up. I suppose another, just to give like a rounded view of this, not to be difficult purposefully because you're being generous with your time, but it's probably important to play devil's advocate in these conversations.
Sure.
People will probably be listening and thinking, well, what about my lawyer? I might actually not really like them, but still work with them because there's a belief in their ability. Or yeah. My real estate agent, my liking them or disliking them is trumped by the property they show me. So are there things that then cancel out the liking factor because other things are more influential on decision making?
Well, I mean, obviously in those scenarios, you're paying those people, right? So in essence, that circumvents liking. Whether they like you or not, if they want to check, they're going to do their job. Now, it would be my advice to find some common ground with them because they're going to take more effort on your behalf as a result. In fact, that's one of the ways we talk with liking is that sometimes you have to like the one you're with. So if it's in a scenario where you're with a person, especially if it could be a conflict situation where an argument could ensue, if early on in your conversation with them, if you can find something that you do like about them and tell them, bring it to the surface early on, then a lot of times that will diffuse, as we like to say, put the pin back in their grenade, diffuse the situation, take some of the emotion out of it, and you'll be able to have a more civil, logical conversation. You know, the path to less friction starts with liking. So that's really your choice, right? If you're stuck with that person, you can't find somebody else to work with that you do like, well, make a lemonade out of lemons, as we say, right? Do the best you can. Find something you do like about them. Keep asking them questions. Find some other common interests and similarities, and you'll help repair that relationship and get a better result for you both.
Nice. Good stuff. And then this one, this is the one, Chris, that when I think about sales, it kind of irks my body, and it's scarcity, and it's that fear of missing out, because, and my human bias is when I think of this, think, oh, if you don't sign up today, the offer will be gone. And I've had so many salespeople say that to me, like, oh, it's the last one. We can do the discount for this day only. And then I've let it go. And I've thought, I'm not falling for your tactics. And then they've come back a few days later and go, oh, we can still do it at that price anyway. So where are people going wrong with scarcity? What's a good example of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic point, right? So scarcity is probably the principle that's been abused the most in an unethical way against us, right? And one of the rules we have for ethics is simply this. Is it true? Okay. So scarcity by name is about resources. And if resources are dwindling or really about to run out, that's what motivates us to want that thing more and do more to get it. So an example would be oxygen. So if I told you guys and your listeners that the oxygen in the room you're at right now is about to disappear, it's going to run out. Most of you would prefer to know before that happens versus when it happens, right? Because if you know before it happens, what's it going to motivate you to do? Let's get the heck out of here and go find some oxygen. So the way our brain perceives this, and this is where the fear comes into play. You can't siphon fear out of scarcity. It's about life or death resources. Right? It could be life or death that these things run out. The problem with our brain is it hasn't evolved to the point that it can tell true life or death resources running out from average everyday item things running out. The pull of scarcity is the same, okay? Which means it's apt to motivate people to move. When we don't use this truthfully of what up resources, and we use this in an unethical way, that's when, and people get experience to that time and time again in different areas, industries and whatever, because it is so abused, then it pops up to that rational thought brain again, right? That experience. Oh, wait, I've touched that hot stove before. So if I see a red hot stove moving forward, I've been here. I know this. Don't touch, right? So that's what's happening. Okay. So how do you use scarcity in an ethical way? Because if you want to limit the time an offer is available, that will get more people to move. If you limit the quantity, let's say I'm going to do a $500 special off of whatever, right? I could do a limited time only, but a more powerful way of using that is, hey, I have four $500 specials available. So limit the quantity, right? That's going to make even influence more people to want that thing. But what happens, right? Now I got caller 1, 2, 3, 4 done, but there's 5 through 20 who responded because it really amplifies the effect. What do you do for them? Well, to use this ethically, all you have to do is actually leverage a part of reciprocity, which we call a concession. You know, I'm so sorry. We're going to be truthful. I said I only had 4. I only gave away 4. But I tell you what, since I don't have any of the $500 specials, I do have a couple of the $100 specials. Could I get you a $100 special or a $100 gift card to use instead? Oh, thank you so much. Hey, my pleasure. Let's get you going. Let's get you signed up. Now, I couldn't give them the main thing, so I just offered them the backup of the $100 thing. How many of those can I give away ethically? As many as I want, because I didn't say I'd limit them. So that's really the key, you know, for leveraging scarcity in marketing and in limited time and quantity has lost its luster because everybody's abused it. If you want to bring it back, stay true to your word, right? If you say you're going to limit the number, limit the number, but then have an alternative, something else in that category, a concession to offer them, and you win and your customer's going to win as well.
And so then I think of like the psychology that you were saying there about like the oxygen analogy. I think that's beautiful. And my brain thinks of like two examples, one probably not so modern. And I think of like tulip mania, where people used to sell their houses to buy tulips. And then I think of, I don't know if you saw it last year, but with KSI and Logan Paul and the Prime drink, that felt like that these bottles of fizzy energy drink or whatever was selling for 30, 50, 100 pounds. What are some examples of maybe things that have happened in the last 5 years where they've absolutely nailed all the principles?
Ooh, you know, it's hard to nail all the principles in one scenario. Usually what happens is there's always one usually available for you to tap into. And if you're lucky, a couple, right? So I'd say it's rare that you can hit on all of them all at one time. I'm trying to think of a specific example. We talked about social proof with the Uber and whatnots. Scarcity, I mean, I remember here in the States, it was kind of hilarious a few years back. Might have been the first go around at the Trump administration or either with Obama or Biden, I can't remember what, but Amazon was going to stop selling not the American flag, but the Southern flag, like the Confederate flag. Okay. And they just made this big announcement, you know, we're not selling this flag anymore. It's disrespectful and all these other things. And what do you think happened to Confederate flags on Amazon as soon as they made that announcement? They sold so many, it shut down Amazon servers for like half a day. It's never happened. Like, it shut the site down. They sold like 200 and some thousand freaking flags in a few minutes. Just ridiculous. And then finally Amazon got their servers back up and life was good. So, I mean, I thought that was an interesting, anytime you put information like that, that you're going to stop doing something and you still give people a second to move, they're going to buy it up in droves because of that. Here at COVID, you know, here in the States, I mean, toilet paper was the scarce resource, you know? So if you were a toilet paper company, COVID was probably one of the best things that ever happened to you because they sold out everywhere. You couldn't find them. You know, people were just afraid we're never going to get them. Shipping's going to shut down. I don't know. I mean, there's probably more examples than we have time on the podcast to share. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that you've just demonstrated that the power of stories as well, how they can become something they probably were never intended to. So the last one that we come onto is unity. Now that would be an interesting place to probably ask you, what does unity cover that we've not already talked about?
Yeah, so unity is our newest principle. It wasn't in the original research. And it kind of came about because we were doing some studies with one of our partners in the UK, Steve Martin, down in South America at a restaurant. And at this restaurant, they were giving children a balloon as they were leaving the restaurant, right? Seeing an opportunity for reciprocity, he decided, why don't we just change that? Why don't we test and give a balloon to every child as they come into the restaurant with their parents, not when they're leaving? And that one simple move, giving a little balloon to a child as they came into the restaurant, increased sales of food-related items for children, okay, by 25%. And it led to another 20% increase in sales of what the adults purchased on top of that. So on the surface, you may think that's reciprocity. A gift was given, right? More food was purchased. But reciprocity is you're the one who receives the gift and you're the one that gives back in kind. Well, here, that's not what happened. The child was given the gift and someone else, the parent, gave back in kind. What was going on? So that study showed Dr. Cialdini there's something else there. Okay. There's something else that he was missing. So he started looking at it more deeper, and that's when he started realizing the connection is unity. Unity is not about you versus me. Okay. We're not opposing each other. It's you are me. We are the same. We are a unit. So we all unite under a certain category, a banner of some kind. Okay. Favorite football team, for instance, people associate and unite under that banner. Religion, culture, geography, right? There's all kinds of things that we can unite ourselves under. But if we find ourselves on the same side as somebody as a part of that unit, and they ask us something, it is very hard to say no to someone within that same unit.
So is this the link to with tribal beings? So if I recognize you're part of my tribe, I immediately feel, okay, we should be helping each other. Is that where this comes from?
Well, that helping each other is internally is reciprocity. But if something is affecting the tribe and they need your help from that aspect, then yeah, you're a part of my tribe. You are me. Therefore, I'm going to be more likely to help you as a result.
Nice. Okay. And last question from me. From what you've seen, did the principles have any differences culturally or geographically? I.e., could they land differently in the UK than in the States?
Yeah, great question. You know, what's interesting is they're universal. That's what our research shows. You know, anthropologists will tell you that the seven principles are really the building blocks behind why societies even, number one, formed and why they function to this day. So because they're so integral in our connections with other people and how we operate, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, okay? What your culture is, what your religion, what continent you grew up on. All of us lean on these principles to decide. Now, what's interesting is some countries, some cultures will put a higher preference or priority on some of the principles versus the others. So that's really where the nuance comes into play. All of us live by them. We are all affected by them to some degree and lean on them to decide. But there are certain principles and certain cultures that make us move more than the others.
Chris, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I feel like there's been so many brilliant takeaways. I think we always try and give something actionable for our audience at the end of, like, where can they apply these in low stakes environments, or what are some low stakes games? So if somebody's wanting to pick one of these principles and they want to take it into everyday life, what would be some low stakes environments that they could start to experiment with these?
Yeah, great question. I mean, obviously, liking is an easy one, right? That's probably the most bungled principle of all of them, because we're too busy. Nobody takes the time to connect with people before they start talking about business, right? So find some connection. I don't care how small. The more, the better. But if you can at least find one, you automatically have a much higher chance of acceptance of what you're going to ask them later as a result. Liking is a low-hanging fruit that most people don't take the time to deal with. Next, I'd say, would be social proof, okay? Social proof is powerful. If you've got evidence that others have said yes to this, done this in the past, had success with this thing you're going to be talking about, or even if your own customers, right, of people that have looked at and bought your past products and services, if you had one of your options that's the most popular, the one the majority of people have chosen, don't hide that information. Share it early on. Okay. You want to build trust, leverage authority, start with that weakness in your case first. Okay. And when possible, if your resources truly are dwindling or could disappear, right, from an ethical standpoint, again, leverage that information early on in the conversation. And if possible, have a backup plan for those that couldn't tap into that main offer. So you can be ethical in using scarcity and still have a concession for those that just wanted to get something for doing what they were going to do anyway.
Brilliant. Chris, thank you so, so much for joining us. If people want to check you out, if they want to get in touch, what should they do? Where should they find you?
Yeah, obviously they can check us out at the Cialdini Institute at our website, cialdini.com. Cialdini is probably one of the most misspelled words out there, but C-I-A-L-D-I-N-I, cialdini.com. You can email me, Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at cialdini.com as well.